Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on debt when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. Now, Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. He said, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with. And others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things. And any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings. We dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. They are the men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time that we wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, we've been talking about debt, and I threw out a wild new concept to you the last time. I said, always save half. I learned that from an old Portuguese fellow, and I thought I'd start off by telling you once more, or reminding you once more. Most Americans, you know, believe that saving half is impossible. In fact, Americans don't save anything. We're at the lowest savings level today in 2007 that we've been in since 1933, 34, and 35 during the heart of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Americans have a negative savings pattern. It never was great. It was 10% back in the 50s and 60s. 10%, 9%, 8%, something like that. I always figured that if you're going to save 10%, hell, you might as well spend it. Go out and have a good time. But if you want to be a diligent saver, then let's get after the savings program and let's have something in mind. Now, Americans don't save because Americans can't wait. And saving is a trait that's developed in a character form that you develop over time. And it shows that I can wait and save for what it is I want to buy. For instance, I want to buy a new Corvette. And this new Corvette's going to cost me $50,000 or $60,000. And I cannot wait 5 years for this new Corvette. I've got to have it right now. So you go down to your local Chevy dealer and you say, well, what do I have to do to get a new Corvette? And the guy says, well, for $500 a month, we'll put you in this Corvette. Maybe it'll be $1,000 a month, I don't know. Now, you know, the guy says, well, I can afford $500 or $1,000 a month, but I can't wait 5 years. Now, let's see, the last time I was talking to a guy, he said these Corvettes sell for about $60,000. $60,000 divided by 60 months, 5 years, is going to be about $1,000 a month. So I can save $1,000 a month. And I can do that for 5 years and walk in and pay cash and own this Corvette. Or I can go down and sign up today for this $1,000 a month and I can have my Corvette today. Which would you rather do? Well, that's a no-brainer. You know, the average guy is going to say, well, I'm going down there and buy that Corvette today. Now, a Corvette, I think, is a luxury item. That's just my kind of a point of view here. But Americans have a different view today about savings and about luxury than they had 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And there's quite a bit of psychology that goes behind that because Americans today are in debt up over their eyeballs. The nation is insolvent. We're going into national bankruptcy. Then we're going into national captivity. And the great party that's been going on since the end of World War II is coming to an end for all of us. Not just the spendthrifts, but all of us. The parties coming to an end. And when it comes to an end, it's not going to be pleasant. That's the bottom line. And we've been warned and told, all of my life at least, you know, that we're living like the ancient Romans. And America is going to be like the ancient Roman Empire. It's going to collapse. It's going to disintegrate. It's going into non-existence. And we have to do this or we have to do that. Or this debacle will come upon us. You know, these are the Chicken Littles, you know, that are telling you that the sky's falling in. And so all of us are going to have an opportunity to witness, and probably in your lifetime. Now, I'm an old man. I may not sit, but you know, if you're young, if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, good opportunity for you to witness the collapse of the great American empire. In fact, it may be the great world empire. Now, listen to this. You know you're trading up when you start your day with a $3 latte from Starbucks instead of a 99-cent cup of coffee from 7-Eleven. You know you're trading up when you splurge on a Coach watch for $205 rather than $22.99 Timex at Target. You know you're trading up when you opt for the near-luxury 3-Series BMW, which costs about $30,000, over a Pontiac, which costs about $20,000. You know you're trading up when you spring for an American girl for your daughter's birthday, that's about $85, and you forego the $11 Barbie at Walmart. You know, the luxury is not just the exclusive territory of the super-rich anymore. American middle-class consumers are trading up. They're paying a premium for luxury items that they value with high-end features or cachet, compensating by trading down in some other area. New luxury products and services appeal to the nearly 50 million American households making $50,000 a year or more. That's according to marketers and researchers who have coined a new word for this trend. It's called mastige. Mastige. That's prestige for the masses. Now, this mass affluence, the masses of the affluent now pay $3 for coffee at Starbucks. They buy $27 Isaac Mazzari pumps at Target, and they stock their kitchens with imported Italian dinnerware from Williams-Sonoma and $6,000 Sub-Zero refrigerators. This phenomenon is best observed by going into Costco. Costco is piled high to the ceiling with stuff that were luxuries the day before yesterday. He's the guy that said that now is James Twitchell. He's the author of Living It Up, America's Love Affair with Luxury. Costco. Piled high to the ceilings with stuff that were luxuries yesterday. Now, this new luxury, these new luxury products are distinguished by either better design, ingredients, or packaging. Technical advantages that translate into functional benefits that consumers can see, can touch, describe, said Michael Silverstein. He's a marketing expert who co-wrote the 2003 book, Trading Up, The New American Luxury, that has popularized the concept. Among the demographic drivers of this trend, according to Silverstein, higher levels of education, an increase in disposable income, and greater numbers of working women with more influence on spending decisions. People have always saved a little here to spend a little there, said Carl Obermiller. He's a professor of marketing at Seattle University. What is different today, though, is a steadily rising standard of living and brand name goods that are more available and more affordable than ever. For better or for worse, almost anyone can have a little taste of luxury. It used to be middle-class Americans didn't know what the super-rich bought or did, Obermiller said, but now we can emulate them. It's not just what yacht the rich are buying. It's what shoes do the rich people wear. To afford luxury, middle-class consumers have to make some trade-offs. Where a person indulges, another person economizes. Now, Becky Hanks has 68,000 miles on her 6-year-old Toyota Camry and plans to drive it until it dies. But the school district communications manager does not scrimp on travel. In fact, last year it was a trip to the British Virgin Islands. In 2002, she and some friends chartered a 37-foot catamaran in Tahiti. The price tag, $2,500 per person. So living the high life is not a part of my day-to-day experience. It's a major treat, said Hanks of Des Moines, Washington. I live it up for, or I save up for it, and then I just eat up every moment of it. Now, Elizabeth Bonbright, the primary splurge is part of her day-to-day experience. And for her, it's gourmet food. She said, I'm pretty picky about my food, and she enjoys cooking elegant meals at home for her family with fresh baked bread and imported food from France, but she shops discount retailers such as Costco for most staples. It's the fresh smell of the herbs. It's a visual and sensory high to shop at high-end markets, said Bonbright. Executive Director of the State Child Care Resource and Referral Network, I guess I'm choosing to pay a little more for that personal gratification. At Costco, customers can simultaneously trade up and trade down at the same checkout stand. Jim Senegal, co-founder and chief executive officer of Costco, calls his 441 warehouse chain the epitome of new luxury. Costco is the largest seller of Dom Perignon champagne in the country and one of the largest retailers of diamonds, he said. Now, peek in the shopping carts being rolled about any Costco warehouse and you're going to see evidence of mestige. Remember? That's prestige for the masses, or the masses rather. That's mastige. It's mastige spending. A $205 Coach watch nestled next to a bag of boneless, skinless chicken breasts. A 12-pack of Duracell batteries sandwiched in next to a $40 bottle of imported French wine. Costco co-founder and chief executive officer Jim Senegal believes consumers are feeling a loss of rapture with low-priced, low-quality merchandise. They're more enamored with high-quality items they can keep and count on. Now, with the mainstreaming of luxury, the purveyors of new luxury are confronted with a paradox. How do we offer affordable luxury while maintaining exclusivity? For instance, if everybody can buy an indulgence, then the indulgence has lost its value, Twitchell said. So, the emergence of a tandem trend, masclusivity, or exclusivity for the masses. So did you get that? You've got mastige, and now you've got masclusivity. Two new words now for us Americans. New luxury items help define us. They define us to ourselves and to others, and they feed our emotional needs, Silverstein said. The way consumers define luxury has changed also. Pam Denzinger, whose Unity marketing firm in Stevens, Pennsylvania, tracks the luxury market, said luxury used to mean simply owning the item, either the Chanel bag or the Tiffany brooch. Today, consumers prize how the item makes them feel. Now, the idea is to give, or that it gives us a lift. It's about wearing the fur on the inside of your jacket, Danzinger said. American consumers enjoy incredible affluence across all income levels, Danzinger notes, and our basements and our attics and our closets are full of stuff. They're full of stuff. We don't need any of this stuff, she said. People feel entitled to luxury. Is it troubling that we're buying all this stuff that we don't need to somehow lift our spirits? Obermiller said that there may be a cost across society when people go upscale without also cutting costs. Personal bankruptcies here in the United States have nearly doubled in the past 12 years. It's easy to get in over your head in a society that seems to glorify overspending and overconsumption, he said. Silverstein dismisses worries about excessive materialism as a media concern. This is about making better decisions, consuming less, he said. It's not about reckless consumption. It's actually a celebration of consumer intelligence and knowledge. Now, when we get into, and that's the end of the article, but when we get into the bottom line, we find that Americans are in debt $84,000. That's your consumer debt, kids. $84,000 up your average. So if you've got less than $84,000, you know, sitting out there on your credit cards, on your consumer list over here, now you get three big expenses. Now tuck this one away. You got your house and your mortgage over here. That's a big expense. And then you got to meet that expense every month. Second big expense is you got this automobile. And this automobile over here is costing you about $9,000 a year. $750 a month, round numbers. And then you get this third big bill, that's your credit cards. That's your consumer debt. And much of this consumer debt's being spent on these new luxuries. Now, I'm not opposed to people driving Corvettes or living in houses or you know, having some luxury items. I mean, if you want to spend $200 for a watch, that's all right by me. Now, I'm the kind of guy, I've got one of those $22 Timexes, although where I'm at here in the Midwest, you don't get a $22 Timex at $35. But my $35 Timex keeps better time than the old dollar pocket watches when I was a kid. Now, I used to be able to walk into a store and buy a watch for a dollar. This is when we were making, you know, $250 a month. And for $250 a month in board and room, you know, I could go in and buy a $1 watch, a wind-up, you know. Now, today cost me $35. Now, that $1 wind-up watch would last about 1 year. Yeah, if you're lucky, maybe the thing might work for 2 years. It never did keep good time. You know, it was plus or minus, you know, 5 minutes a day. It wasn't too bad for a buck. You got to remember that a dollar back in those days was 1/6 of a day's wages. 1/6 of a day's wages. Well, today we're making $16.57 an hour. That's your average. So if we take that average times 8, you should be making about $130 a day. So you take $132 a day, 132, divide that by 35, which means you can buy about 3.77, or about 4 watches in a day. Back in 1955, I could buy 6 watches with a day's work. Today you can only buy 4. But that Timex watch that I admittedly have to pay a little more for today, will last me for years and years. I mean, I've got a couple, 3 of these Timex watches now. And, the reason I have a couple of them is because, the wife is too lazy to put a new battery in it. It isn't that the watch wore out, it's the battery went haywire. And then the only guy that can put a battery into a watch has to be some guy you know at the Walmart store or the Target store or someplace. And so she just says, "Oh, to heck with it," and just buys me another watch. And so now I got 2 or 3. There's nothing wrong with the other two. It's that the batteries have run down. But this watch, it keeps time. Plus or minus, 5 minutes a year, maybe. Maybe it's better than that. I don't know. But they keep better time, and they look better, and they're easier, and they're, for practical purposes, about the same price. We're paying $35 for a watch today. I'm still buying those cheap watches. I never have bought one of those $200, $300, $400 watches. Let me ask you this. If I was to pay, and I've got a Rolex here. I took it in trade. I got this Rolex watch, and it seems to me that it's worth $1,000. Or maybe it's 2,000. I don't know. Somebody, traded it in here for school, and I've got this real expensive Rolex watch. I never wear it. I don't even know where it's at. If you said right now to me, "Well, go get your Rolex," I don't know where it's at. It's tucked away in some desk or some drawer somewhere. It's too expensive to wear. It doesn't keep time. Well, I guess it keeps time. If we put a battery in it, I guess it would keep time. Maybe it isn't even battery powered. Maybe you got to wind it up. I don't know. I think it's one of those you shake your wrist and it winds itself. So yeah, I'm into this luxury thing too. I've got this $1,000 Rolex watch or $2,000 Rolex or whatever these Rolexes cost. I've forgotten now. But it's not a practical tool. It's not something that you use every day like a Timex watch. So I'm kind of wondering, just as a Joe Sixpack consumer over here, of what value is all of this luxury? Somebody went out and bought that Rolex watch and paid, 100 cents on the dollar. When it came in here, the guy got 50 cents on the dollar, trading it for a school. And I got it for 50 cents on the dollar, and I don't even wear it. Don't even use it. So what is all this luxury crap anyway? Well, I think that the last article there kind of tells you what the story is. Makes me feel good. It gives me some kind of exclusivity here. It sets me apart from the rest of you peons out there who don't have a Rolex watch. And I'm sitting here saying, well, so what? I would imagine 99% of the people in the world don't have a Rolex watch. I've got one and don't use it, so I'm not a step further ahead than the average Joe Sixpack living in Uganda, for crying out loud. So, we spend this money. Somebody is out here spending all this money. But does it add anything to our standard of living? Does it add anything to life? Does it get us to the airport on time because you get a $1,000 watch versus a $35 watch? I don't think so. So what it is vanity. And human beings are motivated by 5 motivators. It's called vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Everybody is motivated by those 5 motivators. And as a salesman, I want to sell you this Rolex watch. I mean, if I was selling Corvettes, I'd want to sell you a Corvette. Now, a Corvette is about as practical an automobile as 6 thumbs on your left hand. That's about how practical a Corvette is. It's a ticket waiting to happen. It's an expensive luxury. And when you get into the damn thing, it's not comfortable. I mean, it's like sitting on the floor with your feet stretched out in front of you. They're hard to get into, hard to get out of. They're low to the ground, and if you ever had an accident with one of them, I think that it'd take them a month to cut you out of this envelope, this steel envelope. In fact, they're not even made out of steel. I think they're made out of plastic and glass. That's kind of what I observed. Now, I'm not opposed to people driving Corvettes. I'm just pointing out that, you know, if you want to drive around in this car, make a statement to me and say, hey, I got $60,000 to throw away. I'm better than you. I'm wealthier than you. I've got something you don't have. And I'd sit there and say, well, you know, here where I live in the Ozarks, a Corvette, I'm not, well, you can get it up and down my road because I had a student in here the other day driving a Corvette. And he can get in and out of here, but I think that a four-wheel drive makes more sense. And I'll guarantee you that you wouldn't get that Corvette in here on the old road. Now, on my new road, you know, you can get a Corvette in here, but you got to drive slow, you know. Now, the reason I bring this up is because luxury items, insofar as your life is concerned, are totally extraneous. I mean, you need these luxury items like you need six thumbs on your left hand. You don't need them at all. Now, we used to laugh when Zsa Zsa Gabor, you know, would come into the room. She was an old-timey movie actress. You know, you people today probably wouldn't recognize that name, but Zsa Zsa Gabor, you know, she had a sister, and they came from Hungary. Good-looking woman. And she'd come sweeping into the room, see, and she'd be wearing this $9,000 mink coat, see. And then when, you know, $9,000, you know, 40, 50 years ago is a lot of money. And she'd come sweeping into the room, and she'd swing this coat, you know, off of her arm. She's taking it off as she's walking across the floor. And she would drop it on the floor, this $9,000 mint coat, you know, when $9,000 bought something. And she'd say, darling, darling, you know, as she'd go rush over to this other movie actor, you know, and grab a hold of him, and they'd kiss and embrace, you know. And the objective here was to show that this woman is so wealthy that she can just take a $9,000 coat and fling it on the floor like a cigarette butt. And, of course, to us masses out here, you know, it would make us gasp. First of all, nobody in his right mind could afford a $9,000 coat to start with. And then here's this woman. She just sweeps into the room and drops it on the floor, you know, like a plug of tobacco, you know. And so it would make all of us poor people gasp, you know, at this opulence and this great wealth over here. And I suppose that made her feel real good. But the real practicality of it is you take now some Eskimo living up here in the Yukon or up here in Point Barrow, Alaska. Now, he's got a real need for a fur coat. And he probably takes better care of his fur coat up there in Alaska than Zsa Zsa Gabor did down here in the States. Because, you know, she needed a mink coat, you know, down in Hollywood, California, like she needed six thumbs on her left hand. The guy living up there at Point Barrow, now that mink coat's very important to him because that's a matter of survival. And it probably didn't cost him $6,000 or $9,000, you know, to buy that coat. He killed some animals up there and he sewed those things together, you know, with some buckskin and one thing and another. And it makes a lot of sense for that guy to have a fur coat. Doesn't make any sense at all for her to have a fur coat any more than it would make sense for me to have a Corvette. Which is why I drive a four-wheel drive, you know, because that makes more sense here, because we got a lot of mud and, you know, snow and one thing and another where I live. Now, that Corvette might make a lot of sense on the streets of Los Angeles, but it doesn't make any sense here in Ozark County, Missouri, let me tell you. So why is it that Americans then are spending all this money and going into debt in the process, mortgaging their future, and running into bankruptcy? Bankruptcies, you know, are double what they were 10 years ago. And why is it that we're running up all this debt over here? Is it because we've got an inferiority complex and we're just trying to show off to people? Or is it because we're suffering from vanity and I want to show you that I've got all this money? Now, it's one thing to be a Bill Gates, you know, with $37 billion and you build a $20 million house. You know, that's chicken feed. But you know, when you're a working stiff, you know, when you go out here and you buy a $200,000-$400,000 house, and people are very, very commonly going out here now and buying houses. I'm reading in the International Forecaster about the adjustable rate mortgages and how about $1 trillion worth of those ARMs are now going into foreclosure over the next year, 2 years, and 3 years. I wonder how those people are going to feel when their houses are taken away from them, or do they even care? I don't know. Maybe it would seem like to me that if you're trying to show off to me by flicking your wrist and showing me your $1,000 Rolex over here, and you're getting your house foreclosed on, doesn't seem very prestigious to me. You know, just being an old country boy, it seemed like it'd be more prestigious to me that if you didn't go into bankruptcy or you didn't get foreclosed on. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School or The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is the Law Hour website, I should say, is updated weekly. It has a radio log, our schedule, and our archives. And that can be accessed as well through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one. They're free. 417-273-4967 is the number to call. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out so freely do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite or use here on the Law Hour may be hostile, or they may be political, religious, or economic, or sectarian, or racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. And they're mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Okay, we're talking about debt. Now, Americans measure their wealth by their income. If you're making $100,000 a year, you've arrived. I remember doing a job one time for a fellow by the name of Larry Flint. Larry Flint. He was a publisher of the magazine called Hustler, one of those pornographic magazines. Did a job for him. I think the price of the job was $10,000. 10,000 Federal Reserve Note dollars. And this is back in the 80s. And Larry Flint wrote me a check for the $10,000. Now, this Hustler magazine was doing $12 million a month. their sales were $12 million a month, $144 million a year. And I stayed down there in his house as his house guest for probably a week or two. I was down there two or three times, and I'd be down there about a week each time. And the opulence, you know, for a poor country kid like myself, you know, was just beyond description. For instance, let me describe this for you. You know, for you ordinary truck drivers out there, don't understand opulence. This guy, when he would drive someplace, he never drove himself. And it taught me a valuable lesson. People with money don't have driver's licenses. President Bush doesn't slip behind the wheel, you know, of the president's limousine, you know, and go tooling down Pennsylvania Avenue. He's got a driver. In fact, he travels in an entourage. He drives in the first limousine, and then behind him, well, he's probably in the second or third. There's probably a couple of Secret Service limousines go in front, and then here comes the president, followed by a couple of Secret Service limousines behind, you know. And so there's this entourage. Well, that's the way Larry Flynt traveled. There'd be three or four limousines. And depending upon how important you were in the scheme of things, you know, if you were really important, you'd be riding with Flynt in his limousine. And then if you weren't so important, you'd be riding in one of the limousines behind Mr. Flynt. See? And he threw a dinner there one night, and there was 32 guests at the dinner. I was one of them. And the more important you are, the closer you sit to Mr. Flynt at the head of the table. And then the less important you are, then the further away you are. And this dinner was catered. And the dinner cost $8,000. I asked him, I said, what did dinner cost last night? He said, $8,000. We're going to have a little dinner party for 30. It's catered. $8,000. Now, boys and girls, I've never had an $8,000 meal. You know, I've never had that kind of bread to throw around. And remember, a guy making $12 million a month, you know, I guess you can afford it. Okay, so anyway, I did my job, and I got paid for it, and I went on back home and took the check down to the bank and put it in for collection, and the check bounced. Well, you know, anybody can have a check bounce, and so we put the check through a second time, and the check bounced a second time, so I called Mr. Flynt on the phone. I said, Mr. Flynt, that check you gave me bounced. He said, well, put it through again. I said, I already did. I put it through twice, they won't take it a third time. He said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Send it back, and I'll issue you a new check. I said, okay. I sent it back, he issued a new check, and the second check cleared. But it taught me a lesson about the opulence of the super rich. And that is, just because you're making $12 million a month doesn't mean that you can manage money, balance your checkbook, or pay your bills. Now, that's on $12 million a month. Now, I read a story here the other day. There's a woman by the name of Madonna. I don't know what her last name is. I don't know if it's Madonna Jones or if her name is Sally Madonna. But anyway, she's a movie star or a singer or something, and she makes a lot of money. And it seems to me now, I'm kind of slipping my mind here a little bit because I'm getting old and full of Alzheimer's, I guess, but it seems to me she spends $1 million a month on her household expenses. Now, if it's not $1 million a month, then it's $1 million a year. And that's just to run the house. Kids, you know, us normal people out here, you know, if we had $1 million, we would retire for life. We, you know, we'd stick that in the bank, you know, at 5% interest and live on $50,000 a year for the rest of our lives and live it up and think that we'd, you know, hit the lottery. And this woman, she's spending $1 million a month, I believe the number is. Now, that's $12 million a year just on household expenses. Just to run the house. Now, I'm not begrudging people that have money, you know, a lifestyle like that. But, you know, you and I, the average Joe Sixpack, we're seeing more and more of that on television. And then we're out here trying to emulate that. You know, and if you don't have that kind of money, And let me tell you, the people that have that kind of money, they're having trouble making ends meet. Remember this guy, Michael Jackson? And he had a trial here a couple, 3 years ago. You remember that? He was accused of child molestation. And he got into a financial jam, and he had to sell $100 million worth of Beatles copyrighted material. And he had to sacrifice that. I think it was worth $500 million, and he had to sell it, you know, at a fire sale to raise some quick cash so he could pay his lawyers. And he had to sell it for $100 million. Hey, kids, all we're talking about is bigger numbers with more zeros. You know, they're having the same problems making ends meet that you and I have. That's what the bottom line is. And the reason that they're having a problem making ends meet is because they can't manage money. Michael Jackson can't manage his money. Larry Flint can't manage his money. Maybe Madonna can. I don't know. But that's the moral that I'm trying to point out to you, that just because people are making a lot of money doesn't mean that they can manage it. Doesn't mean they can pay their bills. Doesn't mean that because you're a movie star and you're making buku bucks that you don't turn to alcoholism and end up flat-ass broke. And that's, you know, goes part and parcel, you know, with the celebrity scene. Many of these people, you know, they end up flat broke and lose everything they've got. Now, the problem that Americans have is that they're enamored by these big incomes. And so if you're making $100,000 a year, you've arrived. In fact, you're in the top 5% of income earners now if you're at the $100,000 level. And for the rest of us down here that aren't at that 5% level, you know, we're down here trying to, you know, make ends meet and trying to pay the bills and keep the kids in school and pay for the braces and one thing and another. And then we go down here and we buy a $200 watch instead of a $35 watch. And I got to ask, what kind of sense does that make? Is it that the $200 watch keeps better time? Now, I can remember as a kid, remember I said I bought the dollar watch. Now, the dollar watch was the cheapest watch you could buy, and it kept time, you know, plus or minus 5 minutes a day. It wasn't the most accurate thing, but, you know, it'd get you up to the house in time for lunch, which is what was pretty important. Or it would get you down there to milk the cows, you know, at 4 o'clock, which was what the business was all about. I mean, it'd tell you when it was milking time and tell you when it was lunchtime. Then somebody came along and said, oh, we got to have a watch that's more accurate. And so they talk about a watch. I remember they used to advertise these watches. It would keep time within a minute per year. A minute a year. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. But, you know, you had to pay a lot of money, several hundred bucks, to get one of these watches, you know, that would keep time within a minute a year. And I figured, oh, hell, you know, it's not really that crucial that I get down there to milk the cows, you know, at 4 o'clock or at 4:01 or 5 after 4. I mean, hell, if it, you know, 4:15, you know, be within tolerance. And then I read about watches that are so accurate that they keep time to within 5 seconds a year. And I thought, well, do I want to spend $1,000 or $2,000 to buy a watch that keeps time, you know, within 5 seconds a year, you know, for an old farm kid like me, you know, like I said, you know, plus or minus, you know, 10-15 minutes, you know, the cows aren't going to die, you know, if you don't get down there right at 4 o'clock, you know, or within 5 seconds of 4 o'clock, it's not that critical. And so, you know, is it really necessary that we spend all this extra money? Well, the answer is it has nothing to do with your need for a watch that keeps time to within 5 seconds a year, for which you're willing to spend thousands of dollars over a Timex that costs $35. It's that I need to show you my Rolex watch. And so I wear this Rolex watch. And I, what time is it, Bob? Oh, it's, 5 minutes past 4, plus or minus 5 seconds per year off of my $2,000 Rolex watch. What the hell is that all about? You know, you want to know what time it is, you look at your wrist, you know, it's 4 o'clock. It's 5 after 4. It's 10 after 4. But the reason I want to wear this Rolex watch is I want to impress you. Say, I'm going to show you. See, the reason I'm driving this Corvette isn't because it's comfortable or it makes any sense, either economically or it makes any sense because it only carries two people and there's no trunk. Where in the hell are you going to put the suitcase? I don't know what the hell people are thinking about. You got a wife and four kids, and you're going to buy a $60,000 Corvette. What's that all about? And son, what you need is a station wagon. You know, you need a Ford Explorer or something here. You need something that's got some room in it, don't you? Now, you know, people are buying stuff out here called luxury goods over here, and according to the marketers over here, the only purpose behind it over here is to show off. The reason that we're drinking this Starbucks coffee, now I gotta tell you, Starbucks has got a pretty good product. I like their coffee. In fact, when I'm over at the DX station, you know, I oftentimes go to the cooler and pull out one of them Starbucks, and I think they cost, I don't know, are they $2 or $3? Or maybe it's $1.79 or something. I kind of forget now, but they're pretty tasty. See, now for I think it's 50 or 60 cents, you can go pour your own coffee. You know, out of the coffee pots. You know, you got to walk across the store there to the coffee pot, and you can pull out I think they're about 69 cents for a cup of coffee, as I recall. And they furnish cream and sugar free, but you can get that Starbucks and it's a couple of bucks. And I got to tell you that it's pretty tasty stuff. And I do drink Starbucks once in a while, but I'm not drinking it every day, and I'm not drinking it because I need to show off to you. It's a pretty tasty product, and I indulge once in a while. I even buy a Hershey candy bar once in a while. Not too often, but once in a while. Now, luxury is something that everybody ought to indulge in, you know, once in a while, but don't you think we should be able to afford it? I mean, it's one thing to go over here and blow $3 on a cup of coffee, but it's something else to blow $60,000 on a Corvette or $30,000 or something like that. And Americans are spending a god-awful amount of money on this thing called luxury. As a sometime procrastinator, I'm all too aware of the wisdom of Parkinson's Law, which posits that work expands to fill the time available for its completion. And as a longtime observer of how people handle their money, I've come to believe that there's a financial corollary to Parkinson's Law. Household spending expands to consume rising income. Let me underline that for you. Household spending expands to consume rising income. Now, remember this Madonna lady? She's spending $1 million a month, $12 million a year running her house. Now, I'll bet you that girl, when she was 15 years old, was not spending $1 million a year. I'll bet you mom and dad were not spending $1 million a year running the household. So, when she hit it big in the movie business, she made a lot of money. And so now it takes $1 million a month to run her household because household spending expands to consume rising income. Well, isn't that going to be kind of a letdown if she, like Michael Jackson, you know, I'm not very impressed with Michael Jackson, you know, the guy that made all that money, because when you've got $500 million, or when you've got $500, you know, you've got a $500 pickup out here, and you have to sell that to me for $100 to raise some quick cash, that doesn't tell me very much about your ability to manage money. So when Michael Jackson has a $500 million asset and he has to liquidate it in a fire sale for $100 million, it tells me the same thing as it tells me about you liquidating your pickup. Can't manage his money. Tells me the same thing about Larry Flint. Can't manage his money. Makes a lot, spends a lot, lives high on the hog. But in the final analysis, Larry Flint had to sell his magazine. I suspect he got into financial trouble and had to sell out. Couldn't maintain it. I don't know that that's true, but I'm just kind of speculating, you know. If I had a business making me $12 million a month, I'd kind of want to hang on to it, wouldn't you? If I got into financial trouble and I had to sell because I couldn't pay my bills, I guess I'd have to sell it at a fire sale, wouldn't I? Well, this law explains why it is that so many people who make a very comfortable living with steadily rising income can't seem to accumulate any wealth. They're always vowing to start saving some real money someday. As soon as their income rises a bit more. Their problem, of course, isn't how much they earn, but how much they spend. And their overspending is likely rooted in an inability to distinguish between needs and wants. Needs and wants. Now, I can run my house a hell of a lot cheaper than $1 million a month. I don't need $1 million a month, you know, to pay the electric bill and the phone bill and, you know, pay the expenses around the house here. Now, the thing that gives you the opportunity to save some money, and the people that I've observed in life that actually have some money, are the people that are able to manage it. Not the people that are able to make it. I've run across a lot of people that make a lot of money. They haven't got a pot to piss in, a place to put it, or a window to throw it out of. That's what my old granny used to say. And that's because they can't manage it, can't handle it. And so, why don't we learn how to manage and handle money? Now, I teach a business school here. I can manage and handle money. I can manage and handle my money, and I can teach you how to manage and handle your money. Now, I told you about this old Portuguese guy who gave me a piece of advice. He says, always save half. So, I told you in the last program, I'm going to tell you once more. Here's the way this is done. It doesn't make any difference how much money Madonna makes. She spends it all. And the reason she's spending $1 million a month is because she's got more money than brains. She's got so damn much money, she just doesn't know what the hell to do with it. And she's got to raise her spending level. I mean, if that woman made twice as much money, she'd have to spend $2 million a month on household expenses. If she made twice that amount of money, she'd have to spend $4 million a month on household expenses. Now, you know, if you just want to throw money away because you don't know what else to do with it, well, get after it. But all of this money, no matter how much these people make, now this woman, you know, is not going to be 22 forever. She's not going to be America's sex idol forever. That is going to be taken over by somebody else. And her record sales and her movie contracts are going to diminish. And the sordid story of Hollywood sex symbols, you know, like Marilyn Monroe, who died at age 36, made a lot of money, got real famous, and then died young. Now, my old Aunt Bessie, I think she was about 85, pushing 90, you know, and she wasn't a good looker, you know, like Marilyn Monroe, but she lived a lot longer. And I think she had just as productive and just as happy a life, you know, probably a little happier than Marilyn. And there might be a little something to be said about that. And my old Aunt Bessie, she never did have $1 million a month to throw away on household expenses, but she always had a pot of beans on the stove, and she always ate well, and, you know, everybody was fed and clothed and housed, and she did a pretty good job. She was able to manage her money. Now, she didn't have $1 million a month, but whatever it is that she had, she was able to manage it. And she wasn't in debt, and she wasn't struggling to make the payments. So there was something to be said about my Uncle Otto and my old Aunt Bessie. My Uncle Buster, he always had plenty of money. Yeah, I don't think he ever had $1 million a month, but he had plenty of money. And he was always able to pay his bills, and he always had a house to live in, a car to drive, and he was never in debt. Well, if he was in debt, I didn't know about it. Now, why is it that some people are in debt, struggling to make ends meet? And I mean they're in debt and struggling to make ends meet, whether they got a $500 million asset like this Jackson guy, or they're spending $1 million a month here, you know, on their household expenses, or they're a truck driver over here just struggling over here to buy fuel for the big rig. What is it? Because you got 12 million Mexicans in this country, and they're not complaining about making ends meet. In fact, they're not only able to make ends meet on $5 an hour. They're able to send $60 billion a year back to Mexico every year. Now, how in the hell is that possible? How is it that a refugee from Vietnam can come over here called a boat person, and in 10 or 15 years, the guy's running a Dunkin' Donuts store, or he's running an apartment house, or he's owning an apartment house and owns the Dunkin' Donuts store and owns an import-export business over here and is doing quite nicely. But when he got here to America, he was flat broke and a refugee that didn't even speak the language. And here you are, an American, and you've got letters after your name, and you've been to the university, you've been to the colleges over here, and you can't make ends meet. You can't pay your bills and you're filing for bankruptcy. Now, what the hell's going on here? That Mexicans and Vietnamese can come here to America. And the answer is, as old Frank told me, he said, listen, where we come from, it is so poor, it is so bad, that any Portuguese can come to America and make it big and make it easy. Could it be that America is so big and so easy that we Americans can't make it here because we don't know what tough is? And so, like a bunch of spoiled kids, we're unable to get our feet on the ground, economically speaking, unable to get our feet on the ground and take hold of the great opportunities that are available here. Now, the other day I was watching the news, and they said the price of gas is $3 a gallon and headed to $4. Yep, that's right. Pretty soon now we're going to be paying $4 a gallon for gas. I'm not complaining about it. It's the inevitable end results of a government gone wild with its printing and spending practices. President Bush, a real smart guy, got elected president of the United States. The guy can't balance the budget. He's got a $2.9 trillion budget. You got 535 clowns in the Congress of the United States. And I defy you to show me one of those senators or representatives that hasn't been to college and hasn't got a degree after his name. And the 535 of them combined cannot manage that budget, the American or the United States budget. And furthermore, they can't even manage their own personal budgets. I don't know why we've hired these people to manage our nation. They're a bunch of incompetents that can't manage their own money, can't manage their own businesses. And we've elected them to run the biggest business in the world. The hell kind of sense does that make? The track record of every politician over the last 50 years is that he cannot balance the budget of the United States of America. That being the case, why do you keep sending Republicans and Democrats back to the Congress? What kind of sense does that make? Now, the definition of insanity is somebody who does the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result each time. Now, kids, you know, you keep sending Republicans and Democrats back to the Congress and they can't balance the budget, but you keep sending them back and they keep promising you that they're going to give you prosperity and they're going to give you a balanced budget or they're going to do this, that, or something else. They haven't done it for 50 years. What makes you think they're going to do it over the next 50? Can you see where we're going with this? I think the nation's gone insane. If you can't manage your money, what in the hell makes you qualified to be an elector who's going to elect the guy that's going to go to Washington to balance the budget of the United States of America? Now, I don't think that with all these degrees that come out of our colleges and universities that the people of America are very well qualified for managing their money. I don't think they can manage it. So if you're in debt and you can't manage your money, you stick around. Next time we're going to take a look at some more of this thing called debt, how to get out of debt and how to avoid debt and how to make some real money for a change. You know, there's some of us out here that know how to make money. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.